This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 23, in which we discuss FX in the FinTech age. I'm delighted to be joined on the show today by an ideal guest to guide us through this territory. Philippe Gellis is CEO of Cantox, who recently passed the $1 billion of business done mark. At that level, you really have left any notion of startup far behind and are much nearer the bank of the river that is financial services. Cantox provide SMEs and mid-cap firms with big co-levels of FX service. One of their clients alone saved €400,000 last year compared to going through their bank. That itself would be justification for talking on this topic. However, I'm pleased to say that I noticed Philippe's insight some long time before he had these kind of achievements under his belt. In a world full of so-called thought leaders, I always felt that Philippe was actually someone who was sharp and insightful. Not that, of course, I'm now putting him under any pressure whatsoever to be sharp and insightful on the show, tee-hee. As you will have noticed, the last 9 months in particular have been full of sugar and spice spin about fintech in general. However, there are few sectors that are actually making waves in terms of the real economy right now. Interestingly, the whole P2P idea is key, I believe, to those that are, albeit that P2P means less and less as a term. P2P online lending and borrowing we've discussed a lot on the podcast this year. It will be interesting to hear about P2P FX, not least of which the different evolutionary paths these two branches have taken. P2P FX, and maybe Philippe can give us a better label, is perhaps less concerned with what one might call purity of mechanism. P2P FX firms, as a generalization, tend to do whatever it takes to execute the trade. They feel comparatively less need to stick with a new FS execution if old FS execution can provide a better or faster price for the client. So there's plenty to talk about, and let's get on with the show. Hi, Philippe. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hello. So as you may understand because of my accent, I'm French, not British. So living in London for the last 4 years. We are quite an unusual company because we are headquartered in London and we have an office in Barcelona, which is quite an amazing city.
So you couldn't decide whether to move north or south of Paris?
It's interesting because we have our venture capital in Paris. So we are London-based, back office in Barcelona, investors in Paris. Quite an unusual proposition for a startup.
Having an office in Barcelona, and I really should have come to see you as it's such a beautiful city, not just with better weather than London, but also the Gaudi architect that was so innovative in its time as well, in the way that fintech has been innovative, although perhaps more beautiful. So it seems a great idea to have an office in such a nice location, and actually it makes me wonder less why you have an office there and more why everyone else doesn't in this modern world of interweb and all that kind of thing. So obviously you're sensible and they're crazy. So why is everyone else crazy and not living in Barcelona?
That's a very good question. And I always speak with people here in the tech industry, not only fintech. And I always say to them that it's so appealing and competitive being in Barcelona that in my view, it makes a lot of sense for many tech companies maybe to split the company between London, where you have definitely a very strong ecosystem, and Barcelona, where you can locate, let's say, positions that require maybe less skilled people or less advanced knowledge. For example, in Cantox, we have the management, all the compliance, and some business development activities.
Those are in Barcelona?
In London. In London. And in Barcelona, we have, for example, all the back office, all the technology, some kind of back office and accounting task. Seeing that Barcelona is probably half price compared to London.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, I was doing a business development gig for a few months for a fintech, which actually was kind of spread around Europe. It was a little bit based in London, a little bit based in Dublin. But all of the tech stuff, all of their products were made in Madrid. And, you know, you always hear in London, the fintech scene, about the developer shortage and how you've got to pay £80,000 to have somebody who can even just log on to his computer. But certainly a couple of years back, you could go to Madrid and for €30,000, you'd get someone very good.
It's the same nowadays, meaning in Barcelona, you can probably have, senior or mid-senior developers, people with 4 or 5 years experience for 35k a year, euros, not pounds.
Yeah.
And people like living there. So when they're in Barcelona, they're usually quite sticky. They don't move and change their job every 6 months. Usually if they receive quite attractive offers from startups in Northern Europe, they don't move because they prefer staying in Barcelona. Yeah. So it's a very nice place to have people and to have teams in my view.
Yes. Okay. Well, I think we'll agree on that. And I'm moving the London FinTech Podcast to Barcelona by the end of the month because it is a much nicer place. And the other macro point here is a socio-economic, socio-political one, which is that there is an unemployment problem in the south of Europe. And if all we keep doing is concentrating in an interweb world more and more in North Europe, we just make that worse. And that's not very good for society, because everyone in London gets more and more stressed, lives in crowded places. And the whole of Southern Europe is kind of got time on its hands. So hopefully you're setting a trend there. So going back to when you weren't a superhero in the fintech world, what made you leave sort of normal corporates and get into the world of FX and startups and all that? Did you wake up one morning and sort of a lightning bolt had struck you and you saw the light and you thought, I'm going in a different direction?
Not really. I was working in Deloitte in consulting strategy, and I had several clients exporting or importing, so with a big FX exposure. And at some point, we started looking really at their P&L balance sheet, and we started understanding that it was quite complex to really understand what banks were charging on FX. So we tried to help them, we tried to negotiate with banks with them, and we definitely discovered that it was a quite non-transparent space. Without speaking, that it was very old school, so it was phone brokerage. So if you want to trade early in the morning or late in the night, you cannot. So at some point we say, look, there is definitely an opportunity here to really serve SMEs and mid-cap companies. We spend 1 year, more or less, really speaking about the idea with clients, so trying to get some kind of client validation before really starting. And in mid-2011, so we just quit Deloitte and we started, so it was 3.5 years ago.
It's very interesting because just in the terms of the people I've met on the scene who are at the head of the peloton furthest up this scale up, a lot of them do come from a kind of strategic consulting background. Those are the kind of people, more than techie people, going back to media narratives. You know, you didn't sit at home in your bedroom typing on a computer and then one day made a company. As I say, you're looking at this strategically and you checked out the market and you did all these sort of sensible grown-up things in the first place. So that's a very differentiating factor compared to many of them. And just talking about this lack of transparency around foreign exchange, back in the day I was global head of fixed interest at Klein Watson Investment side, and obviously foreign exchange came into that. And in a way, it's very ironic that foreign exchange is untransparent, because actually it's just very simple. You know, you've got some euros, you've come back from Barcelona, I've got some pounds, so simply put, I'll give you so many, you give me so many. So in principle, it's one of the simplest markets there is. We're not talking about some digital knock-in, knock-out, put options, swap, strangle, corridor, mumble, mumbles. So at the very simple level, how come FX market as a whole became so opaque and untransparent?
Simply because for the banking oligopoly, it's a very simple way to make a lot of money. When you think about the FX market, it's not only simple, but it's the biggest, largest market in the world. And usually when you're a student in finance, they always teach you that it's the most efficient market in the world.
Exactly, that's right. It's very simple, it's very big, therefore it's efficient, you know?
And this is a big lie in the sense that the FX market, the interbank market, is the largest and most efficient and most liquid in the world. That's absolutely true. But what clients, SMEs and mid-caps are getting is completely different. So this is a fallacy. You know?
Interesting. I mean, it's been a while since I've been dealing in trillions of dollars. Not that I ever dealt in trillions of dollars. I don't have a feel at the moment. If you're doing an interbank, say, dollar-euro trade, and you talk about liquidity, what kind of size of trade can you do without moving the market, as it were, as a fuel?
This is a good question, but you can move a lot of millions. Meaning, in Kentucky, for example, we did our largest transaction. It was $29 million. In a single trade, and in some way we didn't move the market because they gave us a very tight spread. So it was a quite good confirmation that even when you are trading eight figures, it's still very small. So efficiency and liquidity are really, really big. Then it's just a matter of the banking oligopoly really getting a lot of money by charging non-transparent for spread to non-sophisticated clients.
I see that it's a well-made point that the textbooks are right about the interbank market, but not towards the client-facing stuff. So when you were doing your strategic analysis, you thought that, and then you went away and confirmed that the SMEs and small cos are underserved. I've forgotten now who were the first P2Ps to set up in FX, but Zopa set up in 2005. Giles was on the show actually this week as we're recording it, but not by the time I'm releasing this one. And so the idea of peer-to-peer had been around in lending and borrowing for some time. I'm not sure when Currency Cloud set up. They must have been setting up late O's.
I think the first players probably been Currency Fair in 2009. And there is also, if I'm not wrong, a Polish player also set up in 2009.
So it's about 2009, 10, 11. That's the time when this kind of market started. So what was your original, I wouldn't say technical design, but original kind of schematic about, okay, we're going to serve these companies better and we're going to serve them better by doing X. What was your insight into that?
Look, basically, we decided from day one to be a B2B player. And the main reason is we were people coming from Deloitte. So we were people with a business DNA, not a marketing DNA. Yeah. When you think about peer-to-peer effects for consumer, usually the teams, the founders have a marketing DNA. So we were completely different. We had really a business DNA. And we were also convinced that the business market, the business segment were more attractive in the long run because it's harder to scale in the beginning. But then clients are really sticky. They stay with you. They trade much more, much bigger amounts, much more often. You don't need to manage a very big amount of small transaction. We also discovered there was like a barrier to entry related to sophistication. Because when you sell to businesses, you need to sell sport, you need to sell forward, you need to help them understanding the exposure at some point. You need to give them phone support if they need it. So we were quite attracted by that sophistication side, which is not true in the consumer segment. So by default, we say we want a sophisticated product for clients that are not always sophisticated, but that we will educate.
Yes. So let's come on to the clients in a minute. But again, going back to you helping us navigate through this FX in the fintech world, it's an important topological distinction to draw a line between the consumer stuff, which is more marketing driven. And I can say this because it's obvious to save you saying it anyway, which is that TransferWise is a very good example. They spend a lot of money hiring naked people to stand around and freeze to death in January. At the steps of the World Exchange, where I bumped into a lot of naked people painted all sorts of colours, where I found that naked women painted blue are less arousing than you might think, actually. It somehow takes out of context. Anyway, so they're freezing people and getting lots of attention and rubber ducks and all that kind of stuff, which gets sort of more B2B people like me rolling my eyes. So that's one part of it, and that kind of marketing PR perspective. But then you're talking about a very different marketplace, which is B2B, where you're trying to be a solid B2B, as professional as you were at Deloitte's, where your customers might not think so well of you if you started hiring naked people to run around London and cover themselves in soap suds, because they think that wasn't, quotes, professional, unquotes. So that goes down the middle there. And then before we get on to talking about the customers, in terms of how you managed to give them a better deal than the banks? That's an interesting question. So one of the things that always strikes me is that quite often you hear about the internet disintermediates, and I don't think it ever does. It just reintermediates. A new company comes along charging less. And in the case of P2P in online lending and borrowing, it never disintermediates the bank, because all it does is money goes from one bank account to another bank account to another bank account, back to a bank account, back to a bank account. It removes one function, but the money is flowing. Now, in the same way, I'm just thinking that in foreign exchange, eventually the trade will somehow have to hit a bank. So how does that circle work?
I think that speaking about disintermediation in fintech is also a fallacy. I say there is always a middleman in some way. Before it was a bank, now it's a fintech company. Yeah. But there is always someone in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that the big advantage of fintech over banks is efficiency. If you think about lending, so you name it peer-to-peer lending or marketplace lending, I don't really care. The big advantage is that it's much more efficient to distribute funds and credit and mortgages through that platforms than through a bank network. So it's a matter of efficiency. It's not a matter of middlemen. When they say we have to squeeze the middlemen, that's wrong. What's true is that if you consider, for example, FX in a bank, you have the trading floor, below you have the treasury desk, below you have the branch network. So if you are the SME client, you needed some way to pay for the branch, the treasury, the trading. While if you are with a fintech company, you just have in some way to pay for an online platform. It's much more efficient. There is always a middleman in some way.
Exactly.
And I think that the big transformation of fintech or peer-to-peer is that it's more now a matter of marketplace than peer-to-peer, in the sense that it can be lending, it can be FX. It's not always a peer with a peer, meaning a consumer with a consumer, or a business with a business. It's how do I create liquidity in the marketplace, with liquidity coming from a peer, or liquidity coming from a financial institution, but it's not really the point. What's important is that you are much more efficient at distributing something, lending, FX, but it's a matter of efficiency. It's not a matter of intermediation. And if you are more efficient, you charge much lower prices and you can be transparent. So it's a matter of efficiency.
Yes, I agree. And The only reason I'm pausing is that I can see that that's perhaps simpler in FX if you're just sticking to spots than that. Once you start getting into maturities, I think the argument has to get more sophisticated. So let's take mortgages as an example. So Christian Faes from LendInvest was on, and you know, he does bridging loans and done that very successfully around there. You know, and he has aspirations to do mortgages. But of course, if a peer-to-peer lender suddenly wants to do somebody a 25-year mortgage, that's a whole different complexity. The word efficiency is then interesting, but it becomes irrelevant because then you've basically got some treasury function and the mismatching and all this kind of thing. So just on this maturity thing, in terms of the types of FX you offer at the moment, and just for anybody listening who doesn't know the difference, a spot FX means you want to do it as soon as possible, and 1 year forward means you want to do it in a year's time because your cash flow is going to come then. What kind of maturity?
We do up to 1 year.
Up to 1 year?
Yeah. More than 1 year, it's really for quite big and sophisticated clients. SMEs and mid-cap, usually they never try to hedge or to trade.
Oh, that's interesting.
More than 12 months maturity. It's very unusual. We had some demand in the past, but it was quite marginal.
Yeah, it's not worth doing as a business. And then going back to the other challenges of peer-to-peer, so in the online lending and borrowing, they have a problem, which again is never particularly emphasized, which is that you wake up one morning as chief executive of an online lending and borrowing marketplace platform, and you go, oh dear, we've got too many borrowers. Or you wake up and go, oh dear, we've got too many lenders. And by definition, never ever balances out. You've always got too many of one and too many of the other. And one of the things which hasn't had much commentary on the lending platforms is that, certainly at the moment, all the platforms, apart from one, I think, pay the lenders no interest rate at all when their money is sitting there waiting to be lent out, which can be some time, depending on your strategy. And as I was saying at the beginning, peer-to-peer FX has always seemed to have a different philosophy, which is that if you wake up one morning with too many sellers of sterling or buyers of sterling, then you guys and other people in the business will just deal with the marketplace, whatever that is, won't you?
Yeah, when we started, in our case in Kentox, we were pure peer-to-peer.
Right.
You as a business were selling pounds to buy euro. You needed someone looking to buy your pound.
Yeah, so I'd wait a minute, an hour, a day, a week, a month, a year.
And anyway, depending the amount you are looking to trade and the maturity, you can really have no liquidity at some point. Because imagine you say me, I want to trade Australian dollars forward at 3 months, 1 million. Maybe you have no liquidity because it's a bit of an unusual transaction.
Exactly.
So that's why quickly after, we started thinking, look, let's not try to be pure peer-to-peer. Let's try to be a marketplace because finally, what the client is looking for is an online platform, user-friendly, completely transparent prices and low prices. They don't really care where the liquidity comes from. So in the beginning, the platform was working a bit like an eBay platform. So you were doing offers and accepting offers from peers. But when you are an accountant, a financial director, a controller, a treasurer, you don't like this kind of gamification. Yeah, what you want is to come, make your transaction. It's quick, it's smooth, it's transparent, it's really competitive. So we started thinking, look, let's put all the matching philosophy, all the matching technology in the back end. Because really, the client is not here to lose time trying to find counterparties and match transactions. They want something simple, quick, and transparent. So that's when we really started developing the marketplace philosophy. Because we also discovered that when you have a big client maybe trading in 20 currencies, you will never have good liquidity in the most exotic ones. For these ones, you need liquidity coming to the marketplace from a financial institution. So we really thought, look, let's provide the one-stop shop, quick, easy, transparent, competitive, and let's not focus too much on where the liquidity comes from.
Because at the end of the day, although the peer-to-peer implies somebody's on the left hand and somebody's on the right hand, it's not actually like that. From Cantox's perspective, somebody's coming through the website and they want to hit the button called trade.
Exactly.
That's all they're doing. And I like the point about gamification, because again, it's one of the things understated in the online lending and borrowing side, which is that I read some article the other week about some guy who had a great experience with one of the platforms borrowing money, and he was about to hit the bid or offer or whatever it is. And he thought, no, I'll wait a few more days. And he waited a few more days and he got 2% less as an interest rate. You know? Now, again, if you're a bit bored with life and you've got plenty of time in the office and nothing to do, that's quite a fun game to play for several days. But if you're a busy bunny and got other things to do, you just want to go get 11% done.
Exactly.
And not, you know, piss around playing some game. So I can see that that makes sense. And so in terms of the transparency, because again, just talking about the comparison, there's a lot of talk about transparency in the online lending and borrowing marketplaces stuff, but far, far less transparency. Was it LandBay or somebody that's come out recently and is actually very transparent about what they're doing, but most platforms aren't very transparent. So if I deal with Cantox well, London FinTech Podcast Limited or whatever deals with Cantox today, and I do £1,000 into euros, what information do I get back? Well, what does transparency mean in that context?
Transparency means that you know the price and you know the commission before booking your transaction. You know it once you have booked, and you know it in what we name the post-trade. So, for example, if you say me, I will sell 1,000 GBP and buy euro, you input your transaction, and before booking it, you will see the counter value live in euro, because we provide live exchange rate running. You will see a commission, which is a percentage, which will also be disclosed. And at the very same moment you click, this is booked. Meaning we don't work with pre-funding. Many peer-to-peer FX platform for consumer work with a pre-funding philosophy, which means that they will say, if you send me your £1,000, you will get something like 1,000, let's say 100 euro. It's an estimate. You send your pounds, when they reach their bank account, they do the exchange and they give you the final counter value and exchange rate you got. If you are a business, mid-sized business, a bit sophisticated, you cannot trade that way. Because when you click, you want to know the exact counter value.
And also the time you do the deal at as well.
Exactly. You want to know it at the very same moment, not post-transaction.
No, exactly. This is one of the criticisms I'd heard, without getting too close to this sector very much, was that in some cases, people don't get the time of the trade. Well, that's not very transparent. Oh, on Tuesday, I got 129 against the dollar or whatever, it's 159, or it's probably changed. But you didn't know what time. Well, again, that's not as transparent as it might be.
Because to have full transparency, you need to have the exact time. When I say exact, you need to know the hour, minute, second. But the problem is that if you get that transparency post, you have no certainty that it was exactly the time when the trade was really done.
Yeah.
That's why I say we don't like the concept of pre-funding. We like the concept of you go online, you input your transaction, you click. When you click, your trade is booked and you have all the information.
Yeah.
But this makes the business much more complex, because then you have to manage well all the payments and funds coming from client. If someone is late, you have to manage that. Yeah. So it makes your platform and your business more sophisticated than when you work with pre-funding.
Yeah, I mean, all this Herstatt settlement risk and all those kind of things from way back in the day. No, I can see that. And so going back to the transparency, so I do at 11:37, 1,000 GBP into euros, and I see the price and I click the button and I get that price. Who is my counterparty to that trade then? Is it Cantox Limited? You're a broker, aren't you? Or you're a principal in this case?
We are regulated as a financial institution. So who's the counterparty? It depends. If we match you with another business or if we get liquidity through a financial institution, but anyway, we are in the middle. We are the counterparty.
So I get a trade, then I've dealt with Cantox.
Yeah.
Okay, so are you regulated by the PRA then rather than the FCA?
We are regulated by the FCA.
The FCA, oh, interesting.
As a payment institution.
Right, okay. So then you've got the angle of managing all these risks that I've just traded with you and maybe I'm going to be late and all this kind of stuff and, you know, all that kind of thing, which is, as you say, quite complex to manage that well.
Much more complex than in the consumer space with pre-funding.
Yes.
That's why I say, even if conceptually it looks similar, consumer and B2B is completely different.
No, that's interesting, because I haven't picked that up. It's probably my omission, but it's not something that gets much commentary. Fintechs are in FX, and it's all FX, isn't it? And it's just buying and selling currencies. So that's a very interesting comparison. And just to give me a rough feel, I don't know if it's a public number, I mean, if it's not, I have to edit this bit out, but roughly how many deals a day do you do, just in terms of numbers, to give me a feel? 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000? I don't have an idea.
Well, to give you an idea, we are getting close to 100.
A day, right.
But I think that what's a more interesting number is now we are doing more than 100 million euro every month of transactions.
Which is a lot of money.
In the FX market, it's still very small.
Yes.
But it's a lot of money, at least in my opinion.
Yes, it's interesting actually, because a completely different analogy is that quite a while ago, I knew a guy who was at Smith Klein Beecham, probably bought by Glaxo and things since, and he was involved in the drug testing side and that. And what he said to me over Sunday lunch is that, he said, we never know what's going to happen until we put the drugs out there. Because you can test it on 10 people or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000, but you can never test it on a million. And there's a similar thing going back to this journey through being a scale-up, is that you can have a business that works quite well for 10 trades a day, or 100 trades a day, or 1,000. And there are certain things that start cropping up only, like, oh, this is something that happens 1 in 1,000 times, or this happens 1 in 10,000 times. So presumably this is part of the growth curve about being made a more robust business, because once you've done a billion, you know far, far more than once you've done a million. And once you've done 10 billion, you will have found the more rare events, and you'll gradually become more and more like a BMW factory.
Yeah.
It's all engineered and all precise, and you know nothing's going to surprise you.
Definitely. What you are looking to buy is, in some ways, a machine, you know?
Yeah.
That works. with one client, with 10, with 1,000, with 10,000.
Yes.
Because then in some way it's managing information. Meaning you are managing clients' funds, but managing funds, it's managing information. So what we are building is a machine able to manage an infinite volume of information.
Yeah, so that's an interesting journey in itself. I mean, one of the VC phrases one hears is tech debt. You know, lots of startups and actually some scale-ups get quite a long way pretty quickly, but there's some string and sellotape in there that shouldn't be. And at some point, they've got to re-engineer that into a more robust thing. I mean, how's your growth curve worked on that? Are you constantly, you know, kind of running a system and then you've got a parallel one being built, or is it?
No, it's a single system that's evolving permanently. In the sense that what's fine with cloud computing, to say it in a simple way, is that if you build well your system, I'm speaking about the architecture, then it's very scalable, because then it's a matter of using more cloud computing resources, you know, in the sense that what we always try to do, it's really a target for the tech team, is to have a system, a platform, able to manage at any point of time 10 times more transactions than what we really have. It's a simple target.
Yeah.
You have a number in mind.
I mean, there's a similar thing in the podcasting world that if you're doing it properly, you've got to have a host that can suddenly cope with an infinite amount. Because, you know, I'm going along and the shows these days get sort of 600 to 800 downloads, and then one day Philippe's on it and it gets 1 million downloads. I've got a contract with my file hosters that will cope with that rather than it suddenly falls over. You know, these things need to be thought through in advance. So that's interesting. So coming back to the customer side, it was interesting because I was talking to somebody from one of the banks, and again, with listeners of the show will know my distrust of narratives that one tends to read in the world. And one of the narratives is these big stupid banks, you know, not treating their clients well, blah, blah, blah. Well, of course, that happens sometimes, but it doesn't happen all the time. There are lots of good people in banks, lots of good banks. And this bank had put together a whole raft of, I didn't know whether it was products or applications or something like that, but basically to help the corporate treasurer do FX and interest rate products and all these kind of things. And that, you know, my insider chum said, actually, they were very good. They were very good. It doesn't matter really whether it's some big bank or a small company or something. They were just a good bunch of products. And the problem that they'd found in that case, the weakest link in the chain was the customer side. So the customer was too lazy, / too busy, / too stupid, / didn't care, / whatever, and never actually got around to using them. So they spent all this money internally developing these tools, but they found actually the problem was in the last mile. So maybe it's because you're a fintech in culture and you've kept it simple or something like that, but what have you found about the challenges? I mean, you can produce something wonderful, but then I'm some corporate treasurer, you know, and your sales guy speaking to me, I'll say, yeah, that sounds great. Look, give me a call next week because I'm a bit busy now and I'll never get around, you know. What's the way around that issue? Has it been a real issue for you, or am I just making it up?
It's probably a complex question, but what's true is corporate treasury is, let's say, not a very innovative field. So if you think that just by releasing a new product, all your clients will start using it, and it will sell itself in some way, you're probably wrong, in the sense that you need in some way to also educate customer, show him the product, support him when needed. You cannot just release something and think that by default they will all use it. Maybe it works in consumer with smart marketing. In B2B it's different. You need at some point to educate your client. But I think also that the problem is, I don't really know the product you're speaking about, but banks, I think, are first not good at providing a complete user experience, in the sense that maybe they can develop a smart treasury product, but maybe it will be lost among many more stuff on the banking platform. Then the user experience and user interface will maybe be very different from the rest of the platform. So this is some kind of friction. And then I think the main problem they have is they're unable to evolve the product quickly based on customer needs and customer feedback, simply because the banking system, the banking technology is not really flexible and they're not able to move fast. So they can spend a lot of time and money developing something new and maybe powerful, but then they're not able to keep the pace of educating, changing a bit the product, adapting the product, integrating customer feedback in the product. It's not only a matter of product, it's a matter of philosophy around the product. And I think that banks are not really product-oriented, in the sense that they do not start with what the customer is really looking for. They start with what they think is useful for the customer and also what they think is profitable for them.
Yeah. They're producer-driven, they're not consumer-driven.
Definitely not.
Yeah, the mentality. So anyway, if you're a small business, you have to start by giving the clients what they want, otherwise you're never going to grow. I think the final thing, Philippe, before we get on to Cantox in a bit more detail, talking about the FX in a fintech world and the FX platform industry as a whole, as you've explained it, there are some more nuanced and sophisticated risks that there were in the FX platform compared to the P2Ps, where they just try and be an agent connecting people in terms of delivery risk and all that kind of thing. So as a whole, does the FCA require firms to hold capital against these kind of principal risks?
Yeah, depending on how much turnover, so how much volume you trade, you have capital requirements. And we think it's a good thing, meaning we think that regulation is a good thing. Yeah. Some people always say that regulation is painful. We don't think. We think regulation is good. We think that the FCA in general is quite supportive of fintech, and we think it's something really good. What's true is that regulation has been done in the past mainly thinking about banks and traditional financial institutions. So it doesn't always fit what fintech businesses are. But we think this is something that's changing, and we are quite happy with regulation here in the UK.
That does remind me of one thing where there weren't so many capital requirements before we go on, which is I was very interested to see, interested as I'm no longer in the FX market, I would have been less interested if I was involved in it, the Swiss franc changed a little while ago, and that was a surprise to quite a number of people. And one of the interesting things from a business model perspective is that there were a number of foreign exchange brokers out there who saw themselves as agents, only taking agency risk. We're not taking any principal risk. We don't need capital requirements. And then in some extreme events have a habit of happening quite often in financial services in the last few decades. Then suddenly, before you know it, all these agents end up with principal risk because their client was leveraged and can't blah, 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 blah. And then a few of them fell over. I mean, you know, how do you see that from a fintech perspective, that phenomenon?
It's a completely different space. Because here we are speaking about FX speculative trading. To be honest, in Canton, this is a space we don't really like because we are not supportive of speculation. And what we don't like is that very often people don't really see the difference. Because they miss the difference between what we do for businesses or players that do it for consumers. So it's real money, Monegu exchange, no leverage, and then all these speculative trading platforms with incredible leverages that make that gain and losses may be huge. That in our view are not well regulated at all, because I think that most people that use them don't really understand the risk. And when you have a big shift in the market, given that the leverage is provided by them, they bankrupt.
Yeah, it's catastrophic. As we saw, a number of them disappeared. Well, again, I'm glad I asked that question, because that's a very useful topology of how this FX in the fintech world exists. Because again, it's night and day, the difference between B2C and B2B, night and day. And it's night and absolutely night and day between people like yourselves that with a zero leverage. Someone puts in X pounds one side and takes out Y euros, and the other game where someone's margining themselves massively. So moving on, Philippe, to Cantox, where you are now, where you're going, what your ambitions are, what's the sort of interesting things for you about the rest of this year and next year? Will you have done 10 billion by Christmas, given you've got 10 times excess capacity?
No, I don't think we'll reach 10 billion. I quite think we will reach a second billion probably around September. So let's say we last 3.5 years to do 1 billion, and we will last 8 or 9 months to do the second billion. We love our space. We love the B2B segment. There is a lot of room to grow. There is a lot of opportunities to make the product, the platform, much more valuable for clients with many tools to really help them manage their FX smartly. This year, we go on being really focused on Europe. Probably that the following year, in 2016, we will start looking to go overseas. But this year, we want to focus in Europe, consolidate our position in Europe, and prepare, let's say, the machine to be able to so 1 billion a month in the mid run.
And going back to this point about clients needing hand-holding and advice, as you say, and bringing up the curve to be able to use these tools. In Europe, how many boots do you need on the ground in each of these countries? Or can you do it all over the interweb and Skype and telephones? Or do you actually need people walking around Frankfurt with Cantox business cards in their pocket?
No, we like the fact that we are an online marketplace. So the distribution channel is online, not offline. We definitely have some key people able to meet big clients when it's necessary, but we don't want at all to have an old-school brokerage philosophy.
Yeah, yeah. Where you take them out with 1,000 beers on a Friday evening.
Exactly, with people with suit and ties trying to look like bankers and then ripping off clients with, let's say, a spread that may quickly increase once you are onboarded as a client. Now, we have a very different philosophy. We think that our growth will mainly come from the product, because our product will be better and is already better, and thanks to smart and clever online marketing. So we are not looking to have thousands of people just across the streets and London, Frankfurt, Paris to sell the product. It's an old school approach.
Yeah. Well, I think this is one of the key things that I've seen many fintechs underestimate, which is that we spoke about naked people and B2C before foreign exchange and all these IDBs in Frankfurt make me think of sort of naked lap dancers. Not that I ever went there myself when I was in Frankfurt, I must say. But one of the things that people underestimate when they're doing B2B with SMEs, even just taking the UK as an example, is that the cost of customer acquisition for SMEs can be massive because they're all over the place. And how do you find them? How do you get to them? You know? And if you have smart marketing, so obviously, again, you've been a strategic consultant in the past, you've done your arithmetic yourself and worked out cost of customer acquisition, but it's not zero.
No. But the question is, what's the cost of acquisition versus the lifetime value? If you have a really high lifetime value, and if it's really much higher than cost of acquisition, the equation works.
Yeah. But there's also another phenomenon. I mean, it's very interesting how these round numbers make a big difference. You know, there was a lot of publicity, quite rightly, given to the achievement of doing a billion. And I think a little while later, Currency Cloud had done 10 billion in their business. And these are big numbers. And they really make these firms look like grown-ups. And that starts attracting opportunity. So I think actually one of the things I don't hear from a business model perspective is that a cost of customer acquisition isn't a constant. And I think the internet has changed that a lot. In the past, it probably was. So you'd send somebody in a motor car to drive around Scunthorpe and they'd find clients, and then they'd go and drive around Northampton and they'd find clients, and it was constant. But just going back to my own experience on the podcast, so 9 months ago, I got no listeners, nobody on the show, nobody wanted to come on it, et cetera, et cetera. So you start like that, and then you try and get the first interview and the first listener and all that kind of thing. And then my cost of acquisition of people to be on the show or people to listen to it or follow us on Twitter was really, really high. But you get to a certain stage, a tipping point or a kind of critical mass, and actually you start to sort of suck stuff in. So my big problem now is actually keeping people off the show rather than getting them on.
This is a good problem to have.
Yeah, exactly. I just need to sort of convert that to sort of keeping all these lap dancers away and I'll be sorted out actually, but one thing at a time. Do you see that kind of phenomenon with your clients, that the more you get known, the more incoming inquiries happen, so the customer acquisition can go to almost zero?
Definitely. Almost zero, no. In B2B, it's almost, I think, impossible to get close to zero. But what's sure is that when you start getting visible and when you start getting a critical mass of customers, it's much easier than to attract the extra customers, in the sense that, for example, if you are strong in an industry, it's much easier to attract more clients from this industry because they know people from this industry you are in business with.
It's your brand and it's trust and all these things which are really, really important when you're dealing with people's money. So if I'd met you in 2011 and you said, do you want to do some foreign exchange? And I said to you, how many have you done? You like my podcast? Said, I haven't done any yet, but it'll be okay. Then it's quite hard. But you've been around, you've done lots of business, and then the trust grows up, and then people trust you. And I think it's that kind of phenomenon which means that the ones at the front of the peloton start leaving the peloton behind, because then that snowballs. And as that snowballs, and it snowballs. And then before you know it, things happen very fast these days. I think easily within 2 or 3 years, most of these markets will have turned into oligopolies again. Whether it's online lending or borrowing or FX, there'll be a few large players in Europe.
But you know what, finally, in the technology industry, more than in any technology, anyone try to build monopoly. If you're in the tech industry, by default, you try to build a monopoly.
And Apple does it quite well.
Meaning everyone. Yeah. Google is a monopoly on online advertising. Yeah. In tech, anyone try to build a monopoly. Then you have spaces like, I don't know, for example, companies like Groupon, for example. I read 2 years ago that in the UK, at some point, Groupon had 40 copycats in the UK. Well, probably at 90% bankruptcy. But there are spaces in which you will never beat a monopoly because there is no real barrier to entry. But by default, anyone in tech is looking to build a monopoly over the long run because monopolies are extremely profitable. Oligopolies are profitable. The rest is usually much less profitable.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing that, again, people from outside... Well, I think people from outside financial services, and you still get a lot of those in fintech, strangely, I think they will fall away. But for people outside financial services, what they don't realize sufficiently is that fintech is more like financial services than it is like tech, because you need a lot of knowledge of foreign exchange. And there's far, far more details involved in it than anybody who's never been in it would ever imagine. So that then becomes a barrier to entry in itself, and that you need some pretty good FX people. Forget the tech.
Yeah, and this is why usually fintech companies are not built by tech people.
Yeah.
Because it's complex, regulation is complex, the business itself is complex. the kind of partners and providers you need. It's a very complex space in that sense. I don't know any fintech company built by a team of techies. Maybe there are some, but...
I can think of an equity crowdfunding which is built by marketers, but then you don't need much tech in the middle.
It's different, but marketers maybe, but purely by tech people, I don't know any.
No, it would go wrong. It would go wrong because as much as FX sounds simple, as much as, payments, that's really easy. I'll just give you something. How hard can that be, you know?
Payments is much more complicated.
Absolutely. It's just a nightmare for I don't know. So just to sort of wind up then, Philippe, if I had a magic wand and I could wave my magic wand and give you a wish that for the rest of the year that something's going to be easy or go away that's a challenge at the moment, what would it be most? What worries you most? Do the industry issues worry you that some other sort of platforms do something naughty and fall over or...?
Now our main challenge is really execution. So our own ability to execute. We are not worried about regulation. We are not worried about competition. There can be more or less competition in a market or another, but we don't think it's something really problematic. We think that our main challenge is execution. So it's the ability of the team to execute and execute and execute.
And what sort of rough increase in personnel numbers do you see over the next 12 months from where you are at the moment? How many people are you at the moment, roughly?
We are 52, and I think in 12 months we will be something like 70, 75, maybe 80. What's fine with B2B is that you don't need to increase your team as much as in consumer. You can have things that are more automated. It's a different approach, so we like also this approach. I think when you start having a big company with hundreds of people, it's also very complicated to manage. I prefer a lean B2B company than a huge consumer company.
Well, that's very interesting. Well, I hope it works out well for you, Philippe. And one of the interesting things I just noticed myself about the kind of body language of the fintechs who are at the front of the peloton, who are moving up the scale-up curve, is that there's a much more of a sense of, when you meet these people, much more of a sense of relaxation and confidence because they've been around long enough to have seen all the things that can go wrong, start to go wrong, sorted it, and be on the top of it. Down the peloton, there's more sort of manic rushing around. And actually, going back to financial services and that, the manic rushing around isn't very good because you need to be calm and methodical and make sure there's nothing that you've actually neglected.
Now in lending, for example, you have so many players spreading out. And I'm not sure it's good because many of them, I think, are not reliable and will not last.
Yeah, well, that's the problem in the industry. There's about 55 of them. They're not going to be 55. Some of them are going to do something stupid. Some of them are going to bust. And that's going to knock around.
And you know what's a bit strange regarding regulation is that it's harder to be regulated to be FX than to be lending.
Well, that's interesting. When you were talking, I was thinking, so why is it different? I'm assuming there's a higher barrier to entry. But the other thing is, as we discussed, doing FX is harder than it is online lending and borrowing. Because online lending is very simple. You've got a list of people who will buy, you've got a list of people who will sell, and okay, you have to filter them. I'm not, you know, but comparatively compared to all these settlement risks and delivery risks and payment risks. And
but when you're doing lending, your clients, the lenders, may lose money big money. So I have always been surprised to think that it's less regulated than us.
Yes. Well, you should read the article that I just wrote, which was published yesterday for AltFi News, on the fact that I'm saying that in peer-to-peer lending and borrowing, no platform tells the lenders what risk they're taking. You put £1,000 into any platform tomorrow, they do not say your expected range of outcomes is within this, plus or minus 2%, with plus or minus 1%, which is what the risk is.
I agree.
So I have taken mon chat and I've put it amongst les pigeons. What is French for pigeon?
Pigeon.
Pigeon. I've put it amongst the pigeons. On which note?
I agree. I see that risk is undervalued. And even more now that we are out of the recession. But what will happen to all the lending if in 6 months we have a true recession? That will be for them, that will be an important milestone. How many lending marketplaces will absorb well a big recession?
Exactly. Good, Philippe. That's been an excellent tour of the FX and the fintech world. And I've certainly learned a number of very important distinctions that I hadn't come across before. And I'm sure the listeners will have found those interesting as well. So I wish you all the luck going forward on the next billions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts of new episodes. Live long and prosper. We
could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight.